WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. No for now, says the U.S. Supreme Court to sending migrants abroad with no due process. In this emergency ruling this morning, the justices stopped the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to send migrants to El Salvador, which the ACLU says was about to happen today. Two Supreme Court justices dissented, Alito and Thomas. ABC's Selena Wang points out.
This comes as Senator Chris Van Hollen is now back in the U.S. after meeting face-to-face with Kilmar Abrego-Garcia, a migrant who was mistakenly sent to that notorious prison in El Salvador. The senator says that Abrego-Garcia was traumatized by his time at the prison and that Salvadoran officials gave him no information about why he was sent there.
An Easter olive branch of sorts from Russian President Putin declaring an Easter truce in the war in Ukraine, assuming, he says, that the Ukrainian side will follow our example. This is ABC News. It was December 2020 in the depths of the pandemic when a six-alarm fire engulfed an 1892 church in Manhattan. Middle Collegiate Church was gutted. Only the stone exterior and its bell remained. Tomorrow, just in time for Easter, the church is reborn. With hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations, the church was able to salvage the auxiliary building and convert it into a new space for worship. The Tiffany windows that got blown out in the fire have been repurposed as a glass dome, the pastor calling it proof of resurrection, proof of faith. Eastern and Western churches will celebrate Easter on the same day this year. Pope Francis and leaders of Orthodox Christianity are pushing for a permanent common Easter date, despite lingering mistrust between denominations. The New York Times says China has stopped buying liquefied natural gas from the United States, the latest sign that Beijing continues to decouple from the U.S. economy. I'm Wayne Cabot, ABC News.
It's more than a place to shop. Schrader's Department Store is a 134-year-old cornerstone in the Manitowoc County community of Two Rivers. It's also the oldest, and not just in the state, but the country, still operated by the same family.
I am fourth generation. We've made the store just our own special spot now.
AJ Schrader runs the store with her sister, and like every generation, grew up working there.
My sisters and I were all raised in the department store from little on. I would wait on customers when I was 12. It's just a part of who we are. Our customers are what open the doors every day.
So it's a mix of new and old, including services like tailoring.
It's just a great place to be.
It really is a slice of Wisconsin you won't find anywhere else. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Tribal turnout set new records in our state Supreme Court election. Judith Ruiz Branch has the story.
The Menominee reservation turnout increased by more than 80% from the spring 2023 election. Both the Red Cliff and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa saw turnout jump more than 60%, according to Wisconsin Conservation Voices. The group works with tribal communities through its Wisconsin Native Vote program. Organizer Maria Haskins says listening sessions, roundtables, and regional dinners have been crucial in building relationships and getting people to the polls.
With people seeing their peers being more active in the polls and becoming more informed about a lot of these issues is what is really motivating them to go out and cast their ballot, because I think that people are realizing their vote is their voice.
Haskins says communities shared concerns at these events about issues like the opioid epidemic, which is severely affecting tribal communities, while drawing the connections of voting to their goal of tribal sovereignty. The Menominee community has seen some of the most dramatic jumps in voter turnout. In 2023, community voting increased by 75% and has seen a 220% increase since 2019. Haskins says she believes the influx reflects the increased tribes are also seeing in representation, with more Native Americans running for office.
Our people deserve to have a voice in what is happening, and we deserve to have the ability to be involved.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, a high near 56. Partly cloudy, lows around 36 tonight. Showers are likely for Sunday with a high near 55. Showers may be a rumble of thunder Sunday night, a low near 41. Showers likely Monday, 55 degrees.
It's 47 right now.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we'll talk about the price of oil with Mr. Global and what that means for consumers. Hour number two, we'll talk about organ donation. I hope you join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. News from the Center, WRCE. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, joined in the Civic Media studios by my producer, Max, and together we are so encouraged by the number of you who are calling in, sending notes about our topic this morning, a special edition of Amicus, a Law Review, as we go into detail to provide some understanding. It's not complete. It is imperfect, but nonetheless, the broad strokes of what's been going on recently in the area of, yes, indeed, Venezuelan migrants and issues related to their deportation, but much larger issues beyond that that go to the rule of law and the notion that we have a nation of checks and balances where one branch of government is obliged to follow the orders of another, and if not, to appeal those and pursue other mechanisms. That's what James Madison put in place with our Constitution. Question no longer whether we're in a constitutional crisis. We are there. Unmistakably, as we have judges now finding that your government is basically in contempt of the courts. The question now is, what do we do about that? And what are the frayed edges of our republic as this goes forward? Focusing right now upon what's going on in Judge James Boasberg's court. This is the place, once again, where all this started a month ago, having to do with this 238-member group of Venezuelan migrants packed up without due process, sent to that prison where they remain to this day. The judge very frustrated, not only in getting answers to whether or not his decision on March 15th was overtly disregarded by this administration. That is contempt. That is a violation of the rule of law. That's a violation of the fundamental notions that underpin our Constitution, but also about what the government is doing, if anything, to get them back to provide the due process. And what did he say this past week in this major order? He said he is frustrated. He's going to get to the bottom of this. He said he is going to come up with some way of giving the Venezuelans some opportunity, he said, to contest their deportations. He said he would order sworn declarations from the Trump administration in an effort to determine who in the administration was responsible for disobeying his instructions. Who is it who's out there who is telling me no? Government up to this point not providing any of those names. He said if that failed to turn up the culprit, Judge Boasberg said he would then require depositions. That's sitting down in front of a court reporter under oath, answering questions under oath under penalty of perjury from officials, or he said, or hold hearings with live witness testimony also under oath to get to the bottom of this. If that technique was unsuccessful, he said, he would refer the case to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution under, yes, indeed, Section 402 of Title 18 of the United States Code. And given the unlikelihood the department under this present administration would bring those charges, Judge Boasberg said he might avail himself of one final opportunity, one final option, a gambit even. He said using a special provision of the criminal contempt law that does indeed permit judges, as the judge overseeing this matter, to appoint a lawyer from outside, not within the Department of Justice, to prosecute the contempt That's an option that's also out there, underscoring the extent to which he is not only animated a month into this, but he is going to get to the bottom of this, and he is going to direct people to provide information. And indeed, if he doesn't get it, if the Department of Justice, upon his referral, does not prosecute his contempt referral there, he may indeed appoint a private attorney to do that prosecution. He's got the authority to do that. Now, what happened, again, lots of things happening in the middle of the night, including just this morning with our Supreme Court. In a single-page order, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, this is the circuit court above Judge Boasberg, said it was entering what's known as an administrative stay. We saw the Supreme Court do this in another case recently, just to give itself more time to consider the validity of these contempt proceedings that are proposed by the trial judge, James Boasberg. So we're going to hear at some point soon from the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia as Judge Boasberg continues to pursue that. In another district court in America, we've got Paula Zinnes, who one day before that, the hearing in front of Judge Boasberg on Wednesday, a day before that, on Tuesday, she is saying the same things. The attorneys who are appearing in front of her in connection with a particular case, you know this well now, his name is Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. He is the individual that, yes, indeed, by the government's own statement, by the statement of our Solicitor General to the Supreme Court, by representations made by the White House, by Homeland Security, by the State Department, improperly included among that 238 group sent to El Salvador, should not have been done. Administrative error, they called it. We know, in fact, the story behind Mr. Abrego Garcia. He came to the United States illegally in 2011. 8 years later, he was arrested while looking for work at a Home Depot in Maryland. But an immigration judge who initially ordered his deportation ultimately determined that he should not be sent back. That's the due process afforded to him at that time. It's called a withholding from removal order. It meant this, and this is the important point. It meant that Mr. Abrego Garcia could stay in the United States with legal protection. And last month, again, Mr. Abrego Garcia was suddenly pulled over by federal immigration authorities, accusing him of being a member of the MS-13 gang, and inaccurately telling him that his protected status had changed. It had not. And within 3 days, he's on a plane. He goes with the other migrants to this high-security prison, which is known for its human rights violations. He is visited by a senator, as you know, just this past week. We know he's alive. We know he's there. We've seen pictures of him. But we know nothing else because, again, the attorneys appearing in front of Judge Sinis back in her courtroom in Maryland are not providing any more information. And indeed, this past Tuesday, she scolds the Trump administration, just like Judge Boasberg did, for dragging their feet, complying with a Supreme Court order, another Supreme Court order that directed the White House to facilitate, that's the word we're using now, to release that Maryland man who was wrongly deported to El Salvador last month. She said just this past Wednesday, to date, nothing has been done. Nothing, she underscored. Stern words coming from any judge, but she said once again, she is intending to force Trump officials to answer questions in writing and in depositions. Again, the same kind of thing that Judge Boasberg is promising about what they've done so far to get Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia out of the prison and back in this country. And she noted that every passing day was another, that Abrego Garcia, he's a 29-year-old father of three, is suffering harm in that Salvadoran custody. And the judge set up a fast schedule for officials to provide documents to sit for depositions. These are orders of the court. In a written order, she said she would allow Mr. Abrego Garcia's lawyers to make 15 requests for documents. She's going to let them ask for the government to produce those, and she will enforce those orders and also to depose them, sit them down, get them into a room, and ask them questions under oath, as many as six of them. Name them, she says, and I will order that they sit down for depositions. That's not an extraordinary thing, but it is very atypical. She also said that the lawyers were entitled to explore the lawful basis, these words, if any, for Mr. Abrego Garcia's continued detention in that prison, including who authorized his initial placement there and who presently authorizes his continued confinement. Is that the President of the United States of America? Is that the Attorney General? Is that the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Homeland Security? Is that the lawyers who are appearing in front of her? She doesn't know because she has not been told. But she said, we're going to move. There will be no tolerance, she said, for gamesmanship or grandstanding. None of that will happen. This, of course, all comes in the wake of her previous hearings in which she has gone down this road before, asking these questions, noting that we deported Mr. Abrego Garcia without notice, legal justification, or due process. She has described the government's behavior as a grievous error. She added the White House, by refusing to retrieve him from one of the most inhumane and dangerous prisons in the world, in a way that has shocked the conscience. That's what this judge has said previously and again this past week. Stunningly, of course, we know that even this past week, more developments. Ensign, the fellow who's appearing in front of the judge, said, you know, if Mr. Abrego Garcia presents himself at a port of entry in this country, we will then facilitate, using the Supreme Court word, his entry to the United States. Judge Zinnes rolling her eyes. She said, not only skeptical, the White House can simply sit back and wait for someone else to free Mr. Abrego Garcia, pointing out that the word facilitate required much more and requires his return. The defendants there remain obligated at a minimum to take steps, she said, available to them toward aiding, assisting, or making easier Abrego Garcia's release from custody. And that was the order that she reaffirmed just this past week. She is not happy. She is not pleased with what your government has said to her. And she is likewise, like Judge Boasberg, is going to get to the bottom of this. We are at crisis point. This is indeed the constitutional crisis that we have talked about. We don't need to ask that question anymore. It is here. We've got a government that is saying no. We've got a government that is saying no to another branch of government and not availing itself, at least not overtly, to the mechanisms through which those kinds of things are contested. And yes, indeed, that leads us to the centerpiece of our broadcast today. And that is what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has said about what Judge Zinnes has said in recent days. All of this, of course, comes on from Judge Zinnes. The administration takes this up to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals, again, in the Fourth Judicial Circuit in our nation, once again, that's West Virginia. It's Virginia. It is Maryland. And it is the Carolinas, North Carolina, South Carolina, kind of the Mid-Atlantic states. They meet in Richmond. Federal Appeals Court, again, this is just this past week. This happens on Thursday. We've talked about what Judge Boasberg did on Wednesday, what Judge Zinnes did on Tuesday, what the Supreme Court did just earlier this Saturday, and now this happens on Thursday. So we're jumping around a bit chronologically, but it helps to understand the mechanisms through all of this. Opinion authored by Judge Harvey Wilkinson III. We shouldn't have to do this in America. We shouldn't, but we do it. He's a very conservative jurist. He's appointed by Ronald Reagan. It's not just simple instructions to the White House. It is also a statement about the rule of law. And in tones that should prompt every single American to stop and digest and understand what he said, here is the three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals telling us not only about what Judge Zinnes has done, but what this administration has done as well in recent days as we come back. You'll hear that, and then we'll take callers about all of this happening here as in our discussion on Amicus, a law review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Matt Nair on air.
Deb Cronmiller from the League of Women Voters talking about the SAVE Act.
The kind of voter fraud that this SAVE Act is targeting would be non-citizen voter fraud.
There is no evidence of this. Zero.
Non-citizens, no. They're not eligible to vote.
There is no reason to increase these restrictions on voting except to stop people who might not vote for them.
Matt Nair on air. Moving soon to its new time. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
If you could change your name, if you could pick your own name, what would you change it to? Daniel Wheeler says, linguistically, Pete's last name is interesting because it requires a wet mouth. Requires a wet mouth to pronounce it correctly. Pete Schwabe, you have to have a wet mouth to say that? That sounds so perverse, Daniel.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are reciting the recent history of America and the history 250 years ago as we observe today the shots heard around the world. Shots now going on, not physical shots, not shots of violence, but inside our courtrooms that shake us to the very core as we think about the future of our nation. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit on Thursday of this week issuing a document that should stand in the annals of our nation's history for all time. They're reviewing what Judge Zinnes has said. They go over the top to praise her for her handling of this case, a decision written by Harvey Wilkinson III. He was appointed by President Ronald Reagan. President George W. Bush considered him naming him to the Supreme Court. Here's what the Court of Appeals says. Take this in. It is difficult, they say, in some cases to get to the very heart of the matter. But in this case, it is not hard at all. The government is asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process that is the foundation of our constitutional order. It claims, in essence, that because it has rid itself of custody, that there is nothing that can be done. Court of Appeals says this should be shocking, not only to judges, but to the intuitive sense of liberty that Americans far removed from courthouses still hold dear. The government asserts that Abrego Garcia is a terrorist and a member of MS-13, perhaps, but perhaps not. Regardless, he is still entitled to due process. If the government is confident of its position, it should be assured that position will prevail in proceedings to terminate the withholding of removal order. Moreover, the government has conceded that Abrego Garcia was wrongly or mistakenly deported. Court of Appeals says, why then should it not make what was wrong right? Supreme Court's decision, they go on to say, remains as always our guidepost. That decision rightly requires the lower courts to give due regard to deference owed to the executive branch in foreign affairs. That would allow sensitive diplomatic negotiations to be removed from public review. It would recognize as well the facilitation of Abrego Garcia's return leaves the executive branch with options in the execution to which the courts may pursue in accordance with the Supreme Court's decision. That decision, they say, struck a balance that does not permit lower courts to leave Article II by the wayside. The Supreme Court's decision does not, however, allow the government to do essentially nothing. It requires the government to facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador and to ensure that his case is handled as it would have been had he not been improperly sent to El Salvador. It goes on to say, facilitate is an active verb. It requires that steps be taken, as the Supreme Court has made perfectly clear. The plain and active meaning of the word cannot be diluted by its constriction, as the government would have us do, to a narrow term of art. The court says we are not bound in this context by a definition crafted by an administrative agency and contained in a mere policy directive. Thus, the Court of Appeals goes on to say, the government's argument that all it must do is remove any domestic barriers to his return is not well taken in light of the Supreme Court's command that the government facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador. Facilitation, the Court of Appeals says, does not permit the admittedly erroneous deportation of an individual to the one country's prison that the withholding order forbids, and further, to do so in disregard of a court order that the government not so subtly spurns. Facilitation, the Court of Appeals says, does not sanction the abrogation of habeas corpus
through the transfer of custody to a foreign land, to a foreign detention center in the manner attempted here. Allowing this would facilitate foreign detention more than it would domestic return. It would reduce the rule of law to lawlessness and tarnish, here we go, the very values of which Americans of diverse views and persuasions have always stood firm. The government is obviously frustrated, the Court of Appeals says, and displeased with the rulings of the court. Let one thing be clear, the Court of Appeals said, court rulings are not above criticism. Criticism keeps us on our toes and helps us to do a better job. Yes, indeed. Court rulings can overstep, and they can further intrude upon the prerogatives of other branches. Courts thus speak with a knowledge of their imperfections, but also with a sense that they instill a fidelity to law that would be sorely missed in their absence. Energy in the executive is much to be respected. It can rescue government from its lassitude and recalibrate imbalances too long unexamined. The knowledge that executive energy is perishable and that if understood properly, impatience with the courts can come. And courts, in turn, are frequently attuned to caution and are often uneasy with the executive branch's breakneck pace. And the differences do not end there. The Court of Appeals goes on to say, the executive is inherently focused upon ends, the judiciary much more upon means. Ends are bestowed on the executive by electoral outcomes. Means are entrusted to all of government, but most especially to the judiciary by the Constitution itself. And finally, the executive possesses enormous powers to prosecute and to deport, but with powers come restraints. If today the executive claims the right to deport without due process and in disregard of court orders, what assurances will there be tomorrow that will not deport American citizens and then disclaim responsibility from bringing them home? Court of Appeals goes on, and what assurances shall there be that the executive will not train its broad discretionary powers upon its political enemies? That threat, the Fourth Circuit says, even if not the actuality, would always be present. And the executive's obligation to, quoting the Constitution, take care that the laws be faithfully executed, would lose its meaning. Today, this is last Thursday, both the United States and the El Salvadoran government disclaim any authority or responsibility to return Albrego Garcia to our nation. We are told that neither government has the power to act. The result will be to leave matters generally and Albrego Garcia specifically in an interminable limbo without recourse to law of any sort. The basic differences between the branches mandates a serious effort at mutual respect. The respect that courts must accord the executive must be reciprocated by the executive's respect for the courts. Too often today, this has not been the case. As calls for impeachment of judges for decisions the executive disfavors and exhortations to disregard court's orders are sadly illustrative. It is thus in this atmosphere that we are reminded of President Eisenhower's sage example. Putting his personal opinions aside, President Eisenhower honored his inescapable duty to enforce the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education. Now the branches come too close to grinding irrevocably against one another in a conflict that promises to diminish both. This is a losing proposition all around. The judiciary will lose much from the constant intimations of its illegitimacy, to which, by dint of custom and detachment, we can only sparingly reply. The executive will lose much from a public perception of its lawlessness and all its attendant contagions. The executive may succeed for a time in weakening the courts, but over time will script the tragic gap between what was and all that might have been, and law in time will sign its epitaph. When we come back, we're going to take callers about that, about the rule of law in America, and about where we go from here, here on Amicus, a Law Review.
News from the center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. No for now, says the U.S. Supreme Court to sending migrants abroad with no due process. In this emergency ruling this morning, the justices stopped the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to send migrants to El Salvador, which the ACLU says was about to happen today. Two Supreme Court justices dissented, Alito and Thomas. ABC's Selena Wang points out.
This comes as Senator Chris Van Hollen is now back in the U.S. after meeting face-to-face with Kilmar Abrego-Garcia, a migrant who was mistakenly sent to that notorious prison in El Salvador. The senator says that Abrego-Garcia was traumatized by his time at the prison and that Salvadoran officials gave him no information about why he was sent there.
An Easter olive branch of sorts from Russian President Putin declaring an Easter truce in the war in Ukraine, assuming, he says, that the Ukrainian side will follow our example. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers win at home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers with a 5-3 victory over the A's. Milwaukee's third win in a row. Game two of the three-game series is tonight. Chad Patrick on the mound for the Crew against the A's right-hander Luis Severino. NBA, the Bucks' Damian Lillard speaking for the first time since being told the pain in his right leg was due to a blood clot.
It was a little bit scary. You know, I think I've had a couple surgeries in my career. You know, I've had things that I've had to deal with, you know, ankle or Achilles, calf, whatever it might be, you know, but those are all things that you go to rehab, you know, you deal with it like that. And then you see you have a blood clot, and obviously that's a thing that can affect your life. One of my closest cousins in 2021 had a blood clot in his calf, and he ended up having a pulmonary embolism and dying. So obviously that's the first thing that comes to mind. You know, I'm just happy to be on the other side of it.
That's the Bucks, Damian Lillard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, a high near 56. Partly cloudy, lows around 36 tonight. Showers are likely for Sunday with a high near 55. Showers may be a rumble of thunder Sunday night, a low near 41. Showers likely Monday, 55 degrees.
Currently, 46 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. While corrosive democracy news from Washington continued this week, state news ranged from good in Delaware and Mississippi, mixed in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, to downright ugly in New Hampshire. Voting Rights Lab reports the Delaware Senate advanced SB 2 and SB 3, constitutional amendments allowing 10 days of early voting and no excuse absentee voting. Legislative versions of both bills passed last year, but the Delaware Supreme Court found that the state constitution didn't enable them. The General Assembly must pass them again next year for them to be adopted. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered Mississippi to redraw state Senate districts for DeSoto County, which it found violated the 1965 Voting Rights Act by diluting a majority black section of the county, according to Mississippi Today. State officials in North Carolina found fewer issues among the 5,000 military and overseas voters than the Supreme Court candidate Jefferson Griffin claimed, but the highly questionable post-election review of voter eligibility continues. Pennsylvania Attorney General Dave Sunday appealed a federal court ruling directing county officials to count otherwise eligible mail-in ballots without a date. The New Hampshire Senate advanced SB 213, which would require voters applying by mail for an absentee ballot to enclose a copy of their birth certificate, U.S. passport, or naturalization papers, almost certainly disenfranchising otherwise eligible voters. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
We are the keepers of the wild. For more than 80 years, we've been committed to conserving the natural landscapes that define our nation. Nothing is more important than maintaining wild spaces for adventurers to explore and wildlife to thrive. We are America's hunters and target shooters. Together with firearm, ammunition, and archery manufacturers, we've supported the conservation of more than 36 million acres of American wildlands. For more information, visit OutdoorStewards.org.
Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee Film Festival Program Director Kirsten Larson and Tim Sowers from the Overture Center in Madison discusses their new lineup. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus a Law Review, spending our entire broadcast this weekend on the calamity that right now is the challenge to the rule of law and the separation of powers in the United States of America, raising the question, what are we prepared to do? What are we prepared to do? Getting some advice on that, some perspective on that, not just from me, not just from you, but from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit that responds to a challenge to what Judge Zinnes has done in saying, I need answers. I want the petitioner here in my court. His name, of course, is Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia. I want some answers, and I want this done. The Court of Appeals, in no uncertain language, saying that, yes, indeed, the executive branch has great authorities and great powers under the Article II language in our Constitution, but so does Article III. And judiciary has a responsibility to determine what the law is and to provide that check and balance. The language of this order is lofty. It is the kind of thing that civics professors and teachers in high schools and colleges and universities across the country should be teaching on Monday morning of this week. Families across the nation should be, if you want to, printing this out or putting it on your screens and doing the kind of recitation that I just did in the past segment, so we understand from this nonpartisan, apolitical panel what America is all about and what that observation today of 250 years since shots heard around the world, Lexington, Concord, means today. And here in the end is how that order finishes. The judges say it is, as we have noted, all too possible to see in this case, again, the case involving Mr. Abrego Garcia, this case an incipient crisis, but it may present an opportunity as well. Here's what the judge says. We cling to the hope that it may not be naive to believe that our good brethren in the executive branch perceive the rule of law as vital to the American ethos. This case presents their unique chance to vindicate that value and to summon the best that is within us all while there is still time. And that is the affirmation from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Here's what the Supreme Court should do, which is nothing. Let that stand. Let that stand as the final word in this case. They do not have to take the appeal. They do not have to pursue an emergency application. They may well do it. But the Court of Appeals has told us everything we need to know about all of these cases and gone beyond just the specifics, as hugely important as they are with respect to Mr. Abrego Garcia, but also told us about who we are as a nation, how this works, and how the rule of law, right now threatened beyond a constitutional crisis, threatening to destroy our very country if we don't push back on this incipient crisis that the Court of Appeals identified. The case, Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia, also brought on behalf of his spouse and his minor child, against Kristi Noem, she is the Homeland Security Secretary, against Pamela Bondi, she is the Attorney General, and against Marco Rubio, he is the Secretary of State. You can read it again to your family, to your friends, to others out there who may be interested in consuming this, as we all must be at this time of great importance in the United States history. We are so appreciative also to have at this time callers on the line for a long period of time. Let's get to those right now. Rick from Waukesha, you've been on the line for a while. Rick, delighted to have you with me this weekend.
Thank you for taking this. I just have a question about the judge's decision in the Supreme Court of the votes. I don't know if this has happened in history before or not, but I think, like, they're shaving the votes. Like, shouldn't it have been unanimous?
You're asking, right. Sure, right? You make a very good point, Rick. The answer is this decision issued quite literally hours ago by the Supreme Court saying, yes, indeed, with respect to those folks in Texas, you got to give them due process. 7-2. It was a split decision. We often get that, of course, in the Supreme Court. Your point, which I'm going to take it to be, on something this important, due process under our Constitution for everybody who's here, not just citizens, it should have been unanimous. Made reference in the Court of Appeals opinion to Brown versus Board of Education. The Chief Justice there worked very hard to get a unanimous opinion. Why? Because it was important to send the message to all Americans that yes, indeed, separate is inherently unequal. There are good things that come from education when somebody who's sitting to the left and the right of me is different from who I am. It was important for the Supreme Court to make that unanimous decision. The answer is it did not come. It did not come hours ago. And yet that is the decision of the Supreme Court. Those people in those deportees, those migrants in Texas, subject to that order, they do have to be given due process. We will see if indeed the administration follows that. Rick, appreciate your very good thought, your very good question here on Amicus.
Thank you.
Jim from Brookfield calling
have a
in.
Good one.
Very good. Jim, Brookfield, also appreciate your being a part of our discussion.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for your expert legal analysis on this constitutional crisis that our nation is facing right at this moment, which years ago would have been unthinkable. And yet here this morning we are, facing this, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, I lived through the Watergate era, and I mean, that's like child's play compared to what we're facing right now. My question is, okay, the judge does rule they're in contempt. Could you please outline, like, what's the first step? When is it officially that they are in contempt? And would it be an individual? Would it be Christy Noem, Bondi, Rubio, the president?
Right.
And what are the steps? What would happen? And what could the administration do? Just ignore it? Or, when are we officially in contempt? Who zeroed in on it? And, how that and what happens, the first initial step?
How does this work? Great question. And we will see, right? Judge Boasberger has outlined what he's going to do to make that happen. The answer is exactly what you described. You attempt as well he is trying to do to find out again who made these decisions, who should be deposed, who should I summon in? And he's got the power to bring them into court. That may happen sometime soon. Maybe you get Christy Noem in. Maybe you get the Attorney General in. Maybe you get the Secretary of State in. Maybe you submit them to these deposition questions outside of court. But he's going to require that somebody take responsibility to give him those answers. And again, he can compel their production at a deposition. He can order them to be in court. Here's the question, once again, which you've implicitly identified. If they don't show up, if they don't cooperate, if they say no, once again, again, way beyond a constitutional crisis, that is then the question of what is happening to America. What is happening to our executive branch that simply says, no, we're not going to follow what a judge says? We know that there have been those times when people have said, gee, you in what army? How are you going to enforce this? Compel me to come in. Andrew Jackson said that the Supreme Court led to the Trail of Tears when he refused to follow what the Supreme Court had told him with respect to our indigenous populations in Georgia years ago. We may be headed to that again. And although there's a process, it assumes that indeed an executive branch authority, whether it's Christy Noem or the attorney general, will say, all right, I will be there and I will respond to those questions. And you can identify here are the people finally getting those answers. If that doesn't happen, the question, Jim, comes back to you and me and everybody else who's calling in and being a part of our discussion this morning. What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared to do to ensure that courts mean something in America and that this president, this executive branch, which up to now has been saying no, does not continue to do just that? There is no good answer to that. That is when, again, Benjamin Franklin, a republic if you can keep it. But there is a process. There is a process. And hopefully, as the Court of Appeals has said, you'll follow it, Mr. President. You'll follow it. You've got an opportunity here. Make good on this. Show the American people what our nation is all about. Jim, call in again, and we'll talk more about what happens, how this practically plays out. Excellent question, as Judge Boasberger administers just that. Thanks so much for being a part of our discussion this weekend. Joe from Madison calling in. Joe, delighted to have you with me once again.
I knew with good chance that this miasma, this tilt-a-whirl of legal opinions and cases and all, that you would give us the lowdown on it and you would be clear and descriptive. And indeed, you have delivered beyond all expectations. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is so helpful. My question has to do with the issue of impeachment. You had
yes.
alluded to it briefly that this administration has threatened impeachment of judges when they don't like the decisions that the judges have. How would this go? I should be smarter about knowing this, but several points. Number one, who does impeachment of judges? What are the charges that you have to have for an impeachment of a judge? What would the administration suggest? And if that impeachment were to go forward under this Republican Congress in some way, then does that put a hold on any of the orders that the judge may have had in reference to these cases? I'd be interested if you could give me a little bit of information about that. And thank you so much for all that you did with this show, putting it together under such time pressures. Thanks, Jim.
Joe, thanks so much, not only for the very kind and thoughtful comments about it. I'm delighted to do this. That's the commission of our program, right, Joe, to be amicus, a friend of the community, and providing that kind of information. Appreciate the comments, and appreciate especially, again, another great, just like Jim's question, a great practical question. How does this play out? The good news here is we have seen this template, Joe, in recent times, because the same way that presidents are impeached, we've never had one actually removed by the Senate, is the same process that applies to federal district court judges. And what that means is you got to begin in the House of Representatives. You got to be able to pass articles of impeachment. And as Gerald Ford said, articles of impeachment, although they do talk in the Constitution about high crimes and misdemeanors, that has been the subject of an awful lot of discussion and dispute and disagreement. The United States House of Representatives can define itself, hopefully, if they have some legitimacy at all, to what exactly it is a judge has done that would suggest that we need to remove that person. There was a Supreme Court justice a long time ago named Samuel Chase, who was impeached basically for political reasons, was not successful in removing him. But the process is the same. The House of Representatives has got to identify exactly what a Judge Boasberg, a Judge Zinnes, other judges, all these other judges around the country, what specifically have they done to violate their oath of office, aside, Joe, from what you've just said, from issuing an opinion that you may not like? That's not a basis for doing it. Nonetheless, the House, if it's got enough votes, and right now it's got a razor-thin majority, as we know, Republicans could issue articles of impeachment, and then you know what the rest of this is all about. It goes over to the Senate. For what? A trial. We've seen this again in recent lifetimes, including mine. And there, of course, the Supreme Court justice presides over the trial of a judge there. Again, that has happened from time to time. Most often, trial court judges who have been impeached, they often resign before that happens. But there again, there is proof. There should be proof to prove up the charges, if at all, before the members of the Senate. There you need a two-thirds majority, that's 67 of them, to remove a judge from his or her position. That's a very high burden. You'd like to think that members of our Senate would recognize these things for what they are, that they're just attacks on the, but not liking or disliking the decisions of a judge. But there again, it's a trial of the sort that we've seen with respect to Donald Trump and Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson many, many years ago in our history. During that time period, of course, to answer your other question, a judge remains in place, right? That judge still is in office. It is only when the United States Senate, if at all, has that 67-member vote, votes to remove that judge. At that point, that judge is no longer a federal district court judge, and then is stripped of all authority. But until that time, all of the orders, all the proceedings continue, and there's nothing about that impeachment. Although publicly you may say, gosh, maybe it tends to suggest that the judge's prior orders should not be followed. Those orders, including the orders these past several days of Judge Zinnes and of Judge Boasberg, and yes, indeed, of the Supreme Court just hours ago, they all have legitimacy, not just historically, but in the laws of our land going forward. They are the law of the case. They are the law that, again, if at all revisited, needs to be revisited by another federal judge, another appeals court judge, another Supreme Court judge. Gosh, we hope that in this time that the members of our Congress do not go down this road, do not pick up on what the president has said, calling for impeachment, that they heed the other thing that our Chief Justice has said, which is, Mr. President, although he didn't call him out by name, we don't impeach judges just because we don't like what they do. We can criticize, as the Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit said, we can criticize them all we want. That's the First Amendment. We don't call for their overthrow. We don't call for them to be ripped from power because of their decisions. That's been our history and that's been our tradition. When we come back, more callers on this important and special edition of Amicus, a Law Review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In recent months, Milwaukee health officials have uncovered significant lead hazards in city schools, mostly due to lead-based paint. Several schools have now been closed as the problem has been found to be more widespread. In late March, city officials formally requested help from the CDC, but in doing so, they learned that the CDC's entire lead program had been eliminated by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is a major problem. Children in the state's largest city are being exposed to lead poisoning at their schools, and the Trump administration is not only refusing to provide assistance, they are eliminating the entire lead program that would help in cases like this one. Now, state and local officials must step up to do something for these kids, since Trump and RFK Jr. are gutting federal support. Milwaukee's children deserve better.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is our final segment of this special edition of Amicus Law Review. Delighted, as always, to be in discussion with you about these hugely important issues that are important, yes, to the Venezuelan migrants and to immigration issues and to all the things that have populated the headlines in recent times, but also to the very nation that we are all about. In the constitutional crisis that we are in right now, appreciate so much your contributions to our discussion as well. Dale, calling in from Wausau, thank you for being a part of our broadcast.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. This denial of due process is the most unconstitutional, illegally troubling thing by far to come out of the Trump administration. And, you know, Trump had said many times that his administration will be looking at vengeance towards any perceived injustices that Trump feels that he has faced. And that would be peaceful protesters, attorneys that have represented people Trump doesn't like, and this, you know, his talk about the homegrown terrorists in this country, that they're horrible people. And so anyone, everyone in this country could be deported, picked up by ICE, and deported to El Salvador or Guantanamo Bay or some other location. And everyone is fair game to Trump's whims on who he'd like to have deported out of the country. And I'll tell you what, from what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing, this one thing, this denial of due process, is the most motivating type thing that I have seen and heard lately, you know, with people all around the country. And I think this denial of due process, this is something that's going to cause the downfall of Trump and his administration. This is just completely lawless. And so that's
and
your thoughts, Jim.
Dale, hear, hear. Exactly. A call to enforce what we are as a nation, right? And again, Dale, your words track completely. The words of the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit when they ask, and what assurance will be that the executive will not train its broad discretionary powers upon others, political enemies? The threat, even if not the actuality, would always be present, and the obligation to take care of the laws be faithfully executed would lose its meaning. Appreciate so much, Dale, those observations. That is the concern. That is the why we are, that is why not in hyperbolic language, we are regrettably acknowledging that we are in a constitutional crisis and asking once again, what are we prepared to do to ensure that not only these judges, but all of us have a right to petition government and have the opportunity to do so in a way that has been our tradition for 238 years. Dale, appreciate so very much your observation. Greg, also calling in. Greg, you've been on the line for a long time. Thank you for your participation.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for taking my call. Quick question about, do those who are actually carrying out, you know, deportations, such as ICE agents, could they face criminal or civil liability? Because, you know, saying you're just following orders, but it's an illegal order, really isn't a valid defense.
Right. And once again, the fact that we're even asking that question, Greg, underscores the, not the absurdity, but the great challenge of all of this, right? They are right now plainly pursuing the orders given them by Kristi Noem, by our Homeland Security Secretary, and even these attorneys appearing in court, right? Plainly on the directive of Attorney General, by the representatives of our State Department, by Marco Rubio. It only goes so far. I was a federal employee for something in excess of 30 years. I took an oath in office not to a particular president or even a particular attorney general, although I had the great honor to be serving under a fellow named Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch and many other attorneys general, even when I was an assistant United States attorney. The notion was always you have a greater allegiance, and that is to the nation and to do what's right. And when that day comes, when you believe that you are doing something that's contrary to the oath of office that all of those Homeland Security, all those ICE agents took, when you're doing that and you feel that you are violating it, you need to voice that, and you need to resign. You need to let them know that you are not going to do that behavior. Indeed, there could be civil lawsuits coming out of this. There may not be criminal prosecutions for people following orders, but plainly, Greg, you're invoking the history that came out of the Second World War as well, right? I was simply following orders. I was not doing anything out of my own sense. There is a sense, a personal sense, of every single federal employee, every state employee, every public service employee to do the right thing. And that's the tension that we're going to be seeing seeing in the days and weeks ahead as the executed orders are done by human beings. Kristi Noem herself is not doing these things. She's directing people to do what may in fact be, and almost certainly are, illegal, unconstitutional things. That's why the days right ahead, especially in the wake of the Supreme Court order of early this morning, Saturday morning, is so interesting. Watch carefully to see what this administration does and does not do. We also have, I know that, Mark, you've been on the line for a long time, don't have a lot of time, but Mark, appreciate your comment as well this morning.
Yeah, we can't let ourselves be distracted from the other things that Trump is doing in all this. I mean, I see this morning where he wants to have the Justice Department take over his Eugene Carroll case, his appeals on that, and for the tariffs that Donald Trump is actually issuing. But care should be taken there to make sure that Donald Trump isn't granting himself exemptions to profit himself as opposed to, you know, his business competitors. You know, he'll give himself an exemption on his Trump products produced in China, where competitors, you know, producing, well, nothing similar, but, you know, the competitors that are actually trying to produce products, and they'll be tariffed, but Trump will not be because of gross violations of fairness and justice on that.
Fairness and decency. And again, Mark, your point, implicit, maybe even explicit in all of that, is we've got processes. Statutes passed by the Congress, our representatives there. They're interpreted by the judges. They're applied by executive branch authorities. That's how the system works. And if it doesn't, or if we've got grievances, again, that's what the First Amendment's all about. That's what our Constitution is about. What do? We apply the processes that are established. What happens? And that's the question where we are today. What happens when indeed the executive branch simply says no? We've come to the end of the rule of law, end of the checks and balances that we have been holding dear. And we also are remembering once again the call not to physical arms, but 250 years ago today, I haven't a man afraid to go. That once again was the response to the British troops, Lexington, Concord, everybody coming forward. No one's afraid. No one's afraid, as you indicated, Mark, to advocate for what is right and decent and good and what America is all about. I thank you all for your contributions, for listening this weekend. As always, we'll be back another weekend down the road and another week coming up of history and of rule of law in America. Have a good weekend, everybody.
News from the Center, WRCE. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll review the weekend news, and Jimmy Cuska, Civic Media Sports Director, will be here to talk about changes coming to the WIAA. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
More than 600 international students and recent grads have had their visas revoked. Here's people that are here 100% legally. We've seen the ICE checklist. Do you wear a Chicago Bulls hoodie? Do you have a tattoo? Check, check, gone. Again, this is about due process and following the Constitution. And if we don't have that, then none of us are safe.
The Todd Albaugh Show, moving soon to its new time, weekdays 2 to 4 on Civic Media and on the app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. Easter brings the promise of one day of peace after 3 years of war. Russian President Putin offering a Sunday ceasefire in Ukraine. Bill Clinton was president April 19, 1995, when a domestic terrorist targeted the federal building in Oklahoma City with a bomb that killed 168 people. This morning, Mr. Clinton delivered the keynote on the site where the building once stood.
I know over the last 30 years, you are probably managing your losses better, but I know the pain has never gone away.
U.S. Supreme Court, in an emergency ruling, stops the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to deport people. On the same day, more migrants in a Texas detention facility were due to be flown out.
The ACLU says they're relieved by this move and that, quote, these men were in imminent danger of spending their lives in a horrific foreign prison without ever having had a chance to go to court.
Selena Wang reporting. This is ABC News.